out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 3rd of May, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Of course, as it's Thursday, we're joined by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, how are you doing today?
I've been better, Sven. This topic we're going to deal with today is very striking and very, very upsetting.
It is. It is quite distressing. Of course, we're going to be talking about Jacob Goodwin and the travesty of justice that's occurred over there in Charlottesville over the last couple of days. Do you want to let us know your thoughts on it first, Matt, and say what went on, and then I'll give some of mine?
Sure, yeah. As you know, I was there. I was in the front lines. There's video of this. I was sprayed with bear mace and was blind for 3 days. I didn't see Mr. Goodwin precisely, but I can tell you, and I think you know this very well, that the communists and the left, Antifa in general, was talking about killing us, talking about dismembering us, that they were going to be armed, this is going to be the fight of all fights, and we showed up with what we needed to defend ourselves, no offensive weapons, none that I ever saw. The police, of course, were nowhere to be found. And so we had to fight our way through their cordons. And by the time I got to the statue, I was blind and I could open my eyes only with great effort. And the cops were laughing at us, laughing at the injured. I'm always very, very pro police, always my whole life. But boy, these guys are really testing. And then just at the time I get there, after all this effort, they call it an unlawful, rally and they force us to leave. And they arrest a handful of guys who didn't leave, and they were convicted just, I guess, a few months ago. Media coverage has been laughable. The helicopter that went down had nothing to do with the rally. It was guarding the motorcade of the governor and was in bad shape. It should never have been flown, but I believe it was deliberately sent up, having crashed before and not been put back together properly. So they sacrificed two straight state troopers to make a point here. So all of us, you know, went there with the idea that these people are going to attack. And as they've been doing for 30 years, well, really ever since Greensboro in the 70s, South Carolina. And so, you know, they have been doing this since at least then, attacking us physically and injuring policemen. And now, quite frankly, because we were able to put 2,000 men in the field, they panicked. And this is their response.
Well, the thing that is really highlighted to me is that in every report that I've seen on this, and I've only seen the mainstream media reports, and they're talking about what went on in the courtroom, and Jacob Goodwin got found guilty of malicious wounding with intent or something like that. Carries a 20-year sentence. And in every one of these reports, it's included the summing up of the prosecution barrister. And the prosecution barrister has pointed out that Jacob Goodwin was wearing a crash helmet or safety helmet, and he was carrying a shield, and he was wearing goggles. And according to her, this means that he's kitted up to go into battle, so he quite clearly wants to attack someone. And I would say, well, no, he quite clearly was expecting to be attacked. He wasn't going in there to attack anyone because he had no weapons. I mean, all those things that she has listed are defensive. It's protective clothing to protect yourself from being attacked. And the person who did have an offensive weapon was DeAndre Harris. I mean, surely anyone that is reading that report is going to think, well, hang on a minute, that's not offensive weapons. The guy is not going in there tooled up. He's going in there with safety clothing on. And surely his lawyer must have said that. I mean, I don't understand how this prosecution barrister could get away with saying that, because I would say that was his main defense, is that he was wearing defensive clothing, safety clothing. He was expecting to be attacked, but he had no weapon with him. He wasn't going there to fight back. He was going there to, you know, sensibly making certain that he wasn't going to get acid in his eyes like you did, that he wasn't going to get bashed over the head like that League of the South guy did, who he went in to help, who this black guy bashed over the head with a mag light, and he had a shield to defend himself with. But he didn't have a club there. He didn't have a knife there with him. He didn't have a gun there with him. You know, he was going in there, you know, without weapons. So how can they say that he was going in there dressed for battle? He was going in there with protective clothing on. I would have thought that was the main defense. I don't know why it wasn't.
I wasn't in the courtroom. Some of my friends were. They've told me that several jurors were falling asleep during his testimony of the defense. There were it was mostly female, very impressionable. And that there was a general fear that he is a dangerous man just by being a neo-Nazi. And they kept using this phrase, neo-Nazi and fascist, you know, to frighten. And if you let this guy out, he's gonna take over the country and create the Fourth Reich. And, well, they couldn't allow that. I mean, the problem with the jury is that they are under no legal obligation to actually impose the reasonable doubt standard. Now, reasonable doubt, which is so easy to do, whether it be the Cosby case or this case, is everywhere. I think a judge would be more likely to apply that faithfully than jurors who probably don't know what it is, especially under these conditions. My experience with lawyers, and which is unfortunately extensive, is that for the most part, they have a lot more to lose by pissing off powerful people in the county than in pissing you off. The defense attorney, I don't know if it was a court appointed or what, but there's no incentive to defend him vigorously. And if he were to be victorious, this lawyer would be in a lot of trouble. I don't know how you can have a fair trial when the city was sponsoring anti-right-wing parades and vigils and everything else the night before. So the city clearly was declaring itself on the side of the left. They should have moved it out of Charlottesville, as Susan Yarbrough said recently. They should have moved it away. And, you know, when we were there, the townsfolk were generally on our side, but they hated the fact that we drew this element, and they were very paranoid about it. And so, you know, you had a frightened jury of mostly females who were told that if you let this guy out, that's it. You know, the world is going to come crashing down. This man was a sacrifice. I spoke to his mother briefly on Facebook before, and this is going to tear the family apart.
Well, that's what it looks like to me as well. You know, it looks to me as if they want to get somebody, and they decided to pick on him. He's going to be the sacrificial lamb, the one that they do get, because I think they're going to struggle with getting some of the others that they've got in court. And one thing that I've always questioned about this is how can you get how can they judge him and say that they are unbiased when it's the city itself? The city of Charlottesville is the plaintiff in a lawsuit against the organizers of Unite the Right and against anybody involved in Unite the Right. And the whole city themselves are the plaintiff in that. So that means anybody from that city is claiming that they are a victim in this. So you've therefore got the so-called victims are now on the jury, and you can't have victims on the jury. You can't have anybody that's associated with the victims on the jury. And yet that's exactly what we've got here. We've got people that are claiming to be victims, other people standing in judgment. And that goes against one of the most fundamental principles of law, is that you cannot judge in your own case. And yet that's exactly what has gone on here. And apparently, the lawyers did move to have this case tried outside of Charlottesville, And that was not allowed for some reason. I don't see how it cannot be allowed when the whole city of Charlottesville is a plaintiff in a case against them. In another case. You know, it's a complete mockery, isn't it? Mockery of justice.
This was a problem with Edgar Steele. And I kind of feel the same way now as I did with him. You know, he was arrested on the really stupid charge of wanting to kill his wife. His wife said this is nonsense. The note wasn't in his handwriting or anything. You know, there was no evidence. And then they killed him in prison. And they realize that the system realizes that they have full freedom here. Who's going to defend the guy? Who's going to care? The media were celebrating his death. And so what's the incentive of following the law or being careful or being scrupulous about anything when you never got to pay any price for it? So I would say the short-term takeaway from this is that a jury might not be the best idea if we're in any kind of trouble. I mean, it could have been any of us. You know, the truth is we all know this, is that the left was going to, you know, as I've been doing for 40 years, claiming they're going to kill us, attack police and everything else. And I recall one of my friends there near the end of the rally saying to the troopers, and I repeated it, guys, listen, we're the only group here that doesn't want to see you dead. What the hell are you doing on their side? You know what they think of you. And yet the police commander there was extremely arrogant and really hated us. And it was very clear that they wanted this riot. They wanted this violence. And this conviction, which is now front page everywhere, is a way to place blame. And now it's the nationalist right. And this may even be used to ban us entirely. You know, political activity now is very circumscribed for our people, both in Great Britain and in the United States.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing a lot of it over here at the moment. We've got a lot of nationalists on remand at the moment that have been accused of wild plots to murder Labour MPs, and we've had nationalist organisations banned as terrorist groups, and we've had journalists banned and from coming into the country, detained and deported. We've got Jez Turner. He's going to be in court next week, by the way. It may be the 10th. Apparently, they're unsure exactly of the exact date, but it will be sometime in the next 2 weeks from the 10th of May onwards, and I'll let listeners know about that nearer the time. But just back to this, Matt, am I right in thinking that you can refuse certain members of the jury if you think that they are going to be biased in any way? And if that is correct, then why didn't he just refuse any members of the jury that were from Charlottesville and say, I want members of a jury that do not have a connection to the so-called victims in this? I don't want members of a jury that are claiming that they are victims in this event. You would think that would, that would be allowed. Is that right? Can you refuse members of the jury?
In America, especially for felony cases, you have in most states, you have unlimited vetoes. Misdemeanors, you have only a few. But, you know, what happens is that the defendant and his lawyer interviews jurors and makes sure that they're – it's actually quite a painstaking process, which is why, you know, judges hate trials and want pleas, because this process takes a very long time to get jurors who aren't biased. I'll just repeat myself and say that this lawyer had absolutely no incentive to be very enthusiastic in his defense.
Do you know what lawyer it was that he had? Do you know any of the details about him? Was he a court-appointed lawyer, or was it a one that he paid for, a particularly good one? Because I did hear he had the same lawyer as Chris Cantwell, but I may be wrong in that.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that court-appointed attorneys are usually guys who just graduated law school. They could be some of the best lawyers because they have everything still fresh in their mind. They just passed the bar. The problem is that they're not getting paid by the case. They're getting paid just a flat fee every year, you know, a flat salary. So their incentive is to, you know, get through the cases as quickly as humanly possible. Again, you have similar problems with a paid attorney. A paid attorneys, if they want to maintain their reputation, you know, can't be fighting the system. Having this, you know, having Mr. Goodwin angry at him is pretty meaningless. Having the city and powerful leftist groups angry at him is very meaningful. And so the incentive structure here is tremendous. I believe he was a private attorney, but in terms of quality of defense, it really shouldn't matter. You know, for the reasons I've stated, the incentive is simply a financial one. You're not being paid by the case. You just want to get through as many cases as possible. But that's balanced by the fact that court-appointed attorneys usually are just out of law school and usually are tremendously knowledgeable because it's all fresh in their minds. They have very little experience, however. And in most states, the court-appointed attorneys work for the prosecution. It's the same group of people.
It's very, very strange that they didn't make use of the fact that he was wearing all this defensive gear to say that he wasn't actually going in on the attack. I mean, maybe his lawyer did say that and it just hasn't been reported by the papers. But it's very strange that every single news report I've seen has made mention of that and sort of pointed to it as being, you know, unquestionable evidence that he was going in there to attack somebody. Whereas to me, it looks like he's going in there to defend himself. But what can he do now to fight back against this? Has he just got to wait until he gets sentenced and then appeal, or what's the deal with the system over there when something like this happens, Matt?
Well, as far as I know, right now, the jury has asked for 10 years. Now, when the jury, this isn't the case in all states, the jury can usually it's a prosecution that requests a certain prison sentence. Having the jury request the sentence is probably far more powerful than even the prosecution. There's absolutely no reason why the judge wouldn't take it and sentence him to a decade in prison. Virginia law states that prisoners have to serve 85% of their sentences. However, in felony cases, however, they can earn credits in prison by getting educated and taking counseling and good behavior and stuff like that. But the last thing that this judge or even these jurors wanted to be tarred with is the idea that this is a good old boys down in down south, making sure that their people get off. No way. Again, more incentive to completely destroy it. Look at the Cosby trial. The simple question about what a quaalude is, that's what he was supposed to have given this girl. A quaalude is a stimulant, not a downer. It was a substitute for cocaine back in the late 70s. His lawyer never asked that question. They just assumed it was a very powerful barbiturate. It is not. Simple things like that could have gotten him off, and they didn't ask. I saw this in the Jerry Sandusky case. I see it all the time. Either that they have too many cases, they're overloaded, they don't care. Well, they're just not that bright. So, but as far as post-conviction relief is what we call it, he's going to be sentenced in August sometime. I'm pretty sure the judge will sentence him to 10 years. I think the maximum is 20. I could be wrong on that because this is a felony and he has to serve 85% of that. Now, my opinion is that sentencing a white nationalist to prison is cruel and unusual punishment. They're well aware of what's going to happen in a mostly black jail. If they put him in protective custody, it means he's in solitary confinement 23 hours a day. So it's very cruel and very unusual. And I'm just wondering if that would actually do anything for him, saying that what's going to happen to this poor kid. I don't know if he has tattoos or anything like that. So they're going to know who he is when he gets to jail, that's for sure.
Well, he doesn't look... He doesn't look like he's the sort of person that's been in trouble with the law before. I mean, normally when these sort of things happen, they have to have a pre-sentencing report and they go to probation officers and psychologists and all the rest of it. And they give a report to the judge of what they actually recommend. And if he's never been in any trouble before, and it seems like he's a good kid. I mean, if you've got an unbiased probation officer, they might give him a good report and say, well, look, it's not actually going to be of any benefit to put him in prison. You might as well, we recommend a suspended sentence and a fine or something. I see that there's talk of a $20,000 fine. Apparently all he did was kick this DeAndre Harris. And in his own words, he was trying to neutralize a threat. And the guy had a mag light. He gashed somebody's head open, requiring untold stitches. How can this DeAndre Harris be walking free when he was the guy that initiated this attack and he left an old boy seriously wounded? And then he was basically just neutralized as a threat. And then he was let go. And yet the people that defended the old boy are the ones that are in trouble for this. I mean, anybody that sees that video is going to see that. This is what I don't understand. The news reports have said people on the left have scrutinized the videos, people on the right have scrutinized the videos. But it's quite clear that it's a black youth that is going in there armed with a weapon and tries to steal a flagpole and then gashes an old boy's head open and then goes off looking for more. And then he basically gets his comeuppance. That's what it looks like to anybody viewing it. And yet the news media are portraying something completely different to what people's eyes are actually seeing when they watch this video.
It's not just his conviction, Goodwin conviction, that's got me so upset and angry, but the fact that Harris has already been tried and acquitted of what everyone can see on this video. So you have video evidence, which apparently wasn't sufficient to convict Harris of assault. So at that moment, you realize that the system has declared itself for the left and is going to really not care about normal procedure, and that there's no chance, unfortunately, for Mr. Goodwin. Now, an appeal is difficult. It's time-consuming. It takes forever. And an appellate court will look at this case, and in all cases, they will look for reasons to not accept the appeal. The bias has to be in favor of the original ruling. So something has to be pretty blatantly obvious for any appellate set of usually three judges to rule. So that's pretty much all he has right now. If other evidence comes up that hasn't been talked about, he could ask for a new trial. Again, that's really hard to do, and appellate courts are packed. And again, for the third time, there's no incentive for these guys to care or to do much for this guy or to act at all on him. Even if they disobey the law, no one's going to care. No one's going to say anything, at least no one with any kind of power.
That's what makes me think that they've used him as some kind of sacrificial lamb. Maybe the case against James Fields is particularly weak, because that looks very weak to me. I mean, he hasn't entered a plea yet, and it looks like his car was attacked, and he panicked and just drove forwards and then drove backwards. And I mean, Jason Kessler has reported on this in his podcast, what he saw when he went to court for the original hearing with James Fields. And apparently afterwards doing that, he just drove away, and the police helicopter went above him. He got out of the car, and the first thing he was saying was, "Is everybody okay? Is everybody okay?" And when he was told that somebody had died, his head was in his hands and he was crying. That's not the action of somebody that's carrying out a deliberate terrorist act. That's the actions of somebody who panicked and has caused, some kind of a tragedy. So, and yet that's the main case that people have been hearing about, is all about how at the Unite the Right rally, a white supremacist decided to run over this fat woman, Heather Heyer, and he did it deliberately. That's the mainstream narrative. So maybe they know that they're going to have to give up on that. They're going to fail on that one. So they're thinking, well, we've got to have somebody. We've got to have somebody that we can blame. We've got to have somebody that we can punish for this and say that it was their fault. And they've decided to pick on him. It could very well be like that.
No, I think you might be right. If that's stalling for the very, I could barely see that evening, and I was able to tell they were trying to tear the windshield off his car to get to him. So these people are animals. Now, because the court system as well as the city has sided with these animals, their violence is just going to increase now, because they've got the message: the government will attack your opponents, not you. We were at Shelbyville in Tennessee. It took us hours to get through the police checkpoints looking for weapons. The left did not have to go through those checkpoints. The police presence was huge but nothing happened. But, the regime is very, very clear on, they are not going to support or be, you know, be objective here. They have no intention of being objective. The media is not. So as far as the Fields case is concerned, it is very weak. Although I have no idea how he got the car there because all the streets were blocked off. So I don't know, you know, I mean, we parked blocks and blocks away. I don't know how he got even near the action, or even where it was. But the point is, there's no incentive to follow the law here. The truth is, as we know, you know, I got started doing this in the late 80s, early 90s, and we could field 15, 20 guys. And we were always made fun of and all kinds of, but now 2000, they got beaten in Sacramento. They got beaten in Texas. They got, you know, they're panicking. The regime has gone too far. And this is the system's response that, okay, we're going to shut these guys down. In the late 80s, there was a pro-life group called Operation Rescue that blocked abortion clinics. Through heavy sentences, they destroyed that organization. Now you have a group like ACT UP, which was a fag age group who were extremely violent. They went out of existence only because their members died. But, you know, they never got in any kind of trouble. The left has been attacking policemen, attacking us in front of policemen for 40 years with no real, with no real repercussions. And their bail is always paid by powerful entities. Often the liberal Protestant churches are doing it. So, you know, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, these people are animals and they're going to get worse because of this. They're going to get more violent because now they know the system's on their side. So, they actually know now they're foot soldiers of the regime.
Well, hasn't there been an investigation into what went on that day, an official investigation that's found out that there were emails that have been hidden, that there wasn't the proper communication, that the order for saying that it was an unlawful assembly, that was written before the unlawful assembly was declared? Is it the violence didn't happen until after the unlawful assembly was declared, that all the procedures weren't followed? Hasn't there been some resignations or something? I'm sure I remember reading a while back that some of this had been exposed, whether it was in town hall meetings or some official investigation or other. I know that I have read in the mainstream media there have been reports that have been truthful of what's going on. So is there an overall investigation into this, into the police actions and the actual authorities' actions in the city on that day? Are we waiting to hear from that, do you know?
No, actually, I think this is now common knowledge that the police completely failed, that the city was so biased against the right that they didn't want to protect them. Even though with a permit, the city now has an obligation to make sure that free speech is not messed with, especially in a political arena. There were resignations. I can't remember who off the top of my head. So there's no doubt about it. But it didn't help Cantwell. It didn't help the three guys who were convicted of not dispersing, you know, what was that, late last year. So, you know, it exists, but it has no impact in the court system. I thought I was going to be in trouble because they had these barricades that looked like the old bike racks, and my foot went through it. I couldn't get it out of it, and I could hardly see. And it was that bald commander who was screaming at me, you know, SOB, this kind of thing, to get out of here. He knew I couldn't see. And so this was the attitude here. So, you know, and I've never seen this before. I've been in a million rallies before, and this is the first time that the cops were essentially working with Antifa.
It was quite horrible to see here at home. I mean, you know, we were watching the live streams of it. A lot of us were watching the live streams of it over here in Britain and just thinking, what the hell is going on? Why are our guys being forced to walk through the Antifa? Why aren't these two sides being kept apart? And I just think that the police are not doing their job. And then you could see on Richard Spencer's live stream, they had all the riot police there. And I was like, well, they've got a permit though. How can they do this? And it was just quite distressing to actually see everything that went on and how the police were just gearing up to start cracking heads when it was the nationalists that were being attacked. And they were only being attacked because the police had failed to do their job and keep the two sides apart. And that to be honest, that this is what happens at these demonstrations. I mean, Tommy Robinson has spoken about it, how it always happened at the EDL demonstrations. They would, the police would not keep the two sides apart, and then there would be trouble. He's done videos on it. He's asked the police about it, and it is a tactic that they use that people need to be prepared for. I mean, obviously, people are going to be prepared for anything like this if it happens again. But you know, it was just a mess all around, I think, that day, and it's poor old Jacob Goodwin that's you know, feeling the brunt of it. We'll have to get his address and obviously encourage people to write to him. We've got a list of political prisoners at Radio Aryan now. You can find it in the sidebar. It looks like a Christmas card, and I do recommend people go and check that out, because we are adding to that all the time. We've got political prisoners in Britain, political prisoners in America, and political prisoners in Germany on there at the moment. So if any of your listeners would like to help, then please do drop a line to them. It keeps their morale up, and it also means that the prison officers are going to treat them well. Okay, Matt, thank you very much for coming on today. It's a shame it's such a distressing subject. We'll hear from you again next week. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Florian Geyer. God bless and hail victory.